The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. While the stock market has closed for the day, I thank you for joining the Free Library of Philadelphia's initial public offering of our version of Twitter with author and artist Katrina Van Graal. Miss Van Graal, a former curator of the ornithological collections at London's National History Museum, a taxidermist, birdbander, and fine artist who graduated from the Royal College of Art, will spend the next hour live-tweeting her unusual and gorgeous new book, The Unfeathered Bird. 25 years in the making, The Unfeathered Bird collects 385 of the artist's avian drawings, bringing to life the structure and elegance of these evanescent creatures, along with Miss Van Graal's witty explanatory essays to make a perfect package. And there's the opening bell. Please welcome Katrina Van Graal.
You found him. Hello, thank you so much for coming. It's really, really lovely to be here. This talk is going to be about the making, inspirations behind the book, The Unfeathered Bird. Those of you who know your bird skeletons will probably notice from the title, this is a bit of a strange title, and that's not actually a swan. So in case you're wondering, if you think Danny Kaye musicals, think of fairy stories, then you'll be on the right track. When you buy your copy of The Unfeathered Bird, which of course you will afterwards, and open it up onto the first page, it says, to Amy. Now, everybody always assumes that Amy is some sort of mentor figure, family friend, teacher, that sort of thing, relative. Here's a clue. This was a review that was written a little while ago, and I got to that bit and thought, oh, shucks, yeah, that's very kind. But then it followed on with the best book ever to have been inspired by a dead duck. Yes, Amy was a dead duck. In fact, she was never actually even a live duck. And by that, I mean she was dead when I actually picked her up off the beach and started taking her to pieces. Now, I was an art student. This is way, way back in 1987, so a long, long, long time ago. I was a fine art student, and what I was looking for that day down on the beach was a dead bird that I could take to pieces gradually, layer by layer, and walking along that day, I found a perfectly fresh dead mallard, probably the victim of rape, because that's what mallards do. The males go after the females, and they shove their heads underwater, and the females drown, but the male has a really good time. So she was actually in perfect condition, apart from being dead. And I found her there on the beach and thought, yes, that's the bird that I've been looking for. So I took her home, and I took her skin off and drew the muscles underneath. And then I took some muscles off, and I drew the muscles underneath that. And then I took some more muscles off, and I drew the muscles underneath those. And layer by layer by layer, stripped her right the way down to the skeleton, drew every single bone from three different angles, and then boiled them all up, and then put them back together again, and then drew the skeleton from three different angles. Now, fact, if you're going to spend several months, because it took several months, if you're going to spend several months with a dead duck, it's really got to have a name. And I christened her Amy. And finally, at the end of my 3 years at art college, I put together all the drawings of Amy into this lovely big book. It's a great big thing. And I had the cover embossed with gold leaf, and it said very proudly, The Anatomy of Birds, which sounds very grand. And there's Amy in her case. I've still got her. She's in my front room. Not the prettiest skeleton in the world, but she's close to me. And this collection of drawings was eventually to grow into the book, which is now The Unfeathered Bird, but it took another 25 years. Now, some people say to me, oh, you draw skeletons, you know, that's a bit odd, you know, whatever turns you on. But in fact, I don't draw skeletons for fun. I was drawing skeletons as background research for my pictures of living birds. And this is one of them. This is one of the pictures that I was doing at that time. This is a couple of skuas chasing a couple of Jaegers, you call them here, chasing a tern. And what I was really, really interested in at that time was Living birds, but also I was a printmaker. I was doing these great big etchings, the great big dry points. And what I was really, really passionate about was the history of natural history art, some of the great natural history publishing projects of all time. So it was a sort of combination of historical interest and real interest in birds and actual art practice. Now, I'm sure this guy needs no introduction at all. He was my one shining hero in the sky. My artwork of living birds was very much inspired by Audubon. And of course, this is the greatest natural history publishing project of all time. This is a picture of Audubon looking very young and handsome at the beginning of his project. And later on, there'll be another picture of him, and there'll be another side of his influence. 25 years ago, he influenced my pictures, but he was to become much, much more important than that to me. One thing I was interested about, with particular regard to Audubon, was the interaction between science and art, and where there's a trade-off between being an illustrator or an artist, and where accuracy and aesthetics sort of maybe conflict or not. One of my other great influences was George Stubbs. And nobody could ever accuse George Stubbs of being a natural history illustrator. You see, the horse attacked by the lion. The other way around up here. I mean, you'd never, ever, ever see this in real life. Very remote chance that a beautiful white stallion would ever actually be confronted by a lion in a dark place, especially not looking that sort of noble and wonderful. Stubbs was a true fine artist, a true romantic painter, but also, though, he did this wonderful background study, this wonderful research, absolutely scientific, absolutely spot on, the anatomy of the horse. So in my books, Stubbs had it absolutely right, the relationship between being a real fine artist and being a scientist. Now, this was some of the way somebody described me at the time. I was a bird bander, training to be a bird bander. I was saving up to go on expeditions abroad. I was passionate about birds, passionate about ornithology. I was skinning birds as a volunteer at my local museum. I was drawing birds. And I was on a bird banding course once, and in fact, I was the only person on the course. And the course leader went home to his wife the first night, and she said, "What's your trainee like, dear?" He said, "She bands, and she skins, and she draws." That's the highest accolade I can think of. So here I am, all those years ago, a bit grimy. I was taking a pelican to pieces here in Senegal, out in the desert. Better not look too closely. So, my tutors, even though they were really keen on Stubbs and fairly keen on Audubon and pretty keen on great publishing projects of the past, couldn't actually see that there was still any room for this any longer. In their books, natural history art equals scientific illustration, period. They were convinced I was on the wrong course, and every 5 minutes they say to me, "Are you absolutely sure you don't want to transfer over to illustration?" This time, because I was doing the anatomical drawing as well as the pictures of live birds, I had this idea that it would be a really good thing to do for other bird artists to actually make a book about bird anatomy, to make things easier for other people, so as they too could know which bone went here and which bone went there and so on, so as it would help the meter inside and on and on, so it would actually help them doing their own artwork in the future. But my tutors weren't really very keen on that idea. They thought I should be doing illustration anyway. And so were all the publishers. They had this idea that anatomy equals academic textbook instead of a book for any sort of art science book. And this is what you can't blame them. You absolutely can't blame them. This is the sort of idea that is in everybody's head when you mention anatomy. Anatomy equals boring textbooks, jargon, long Latin words. It's a book for veterinary students or people that work in labs. This is a short excerpt from a a popular book, an accessible book, all about owls. And it gets to the anatomy bit, and suddenly it talks in a language that nobody can understand. The skull of a typical owl is desmognathic and holorhinal. Voma is usually absent. Basopterygoid processes are functionally developed. The number of cervical vertebrae is 14. The neck is of medium length. The thoracic vertebrae are free and are not ankylosed with the os dorsal. And here we are. This is exactly what people have in mind. The diagram, the textbook, with little pointy arrows and things. Now, here they are listed. This is what you expect from the word anatomy. An anatomy book means these things. So, we don't want any diagrams. There's only one D word as far as I'm concerned, and the D word is drawing. Annotations, the words in Latin, little arrows. I mean, it doesn't really, really matter what something's called. What matters is the visual message. It does to a veterinary student, but my book isn't for veterinary students. It's for ordinary people that care about birds and care about art and any other sort of combination of the two. Technical jargon. We don't need to know what the names are in Latin or in English. Stylized postures. We don't really want those birds with their wing up in the air just standing there like a sort of, you know, no. Birds move, they fly, they dive, they swim, they do all sorts of other things. They very, very rarely stand there like that. Complicated physiology is absolutely wonderful in veterinary textbooks, and I'm very glad that vets studied that sort of thing because they can mend my animals when they get sick. But this wasn't what I wanted to do. And finally, all those pictures of domesticated pigeons and chickens. How dull. Hang on. Actually, domesticated pigeons and chickens are really, really cool. There are some outlandishly wonderful things we've done with domesticated animals, and we'll come to that later on. So we'll leave those in, thank you very much. There we are. So, where can I draw articulate? I wanted to put in a lot of bird species from across the world. Where can I actually draw articulated skeletons of about 200 bird species? In a museum. Yep, easy. And certainly, yes, absolutely, museums are really, really good places. Now, museums have got two sides to them, which I'll come to in a second. For certain species that are hard to come by, in southern England, you don't get many hummingbirds, and I had to go to Cambridge Museum to draw an articulated hummingbird skeleton. Dodo, this is the only actual dodo bit of skin in the whole world. And you might think you've seen dodos in museums. In fact, they're all casts, and they're all models out of chicken feathers and so on. This was the only piece of dodo in the world, and this one's at the museum in Oxford. There's an interesting story behind this, actually, which I'll quickly tell you. This dodo belonged to... This is the only stuffed dodo ever known, and it was passed on to the Oxford Museum centuries ago. But dodos, being big pigeons, they are absolutely full of fat. They've got thin skin and they're fatty, and in those days they didn't have all the chemicals that we have to preserve skins properly, and pigeons are difficult anyway. So this thing started to fall apart, and it started to fall apart, and it started to fall apart, and when you get too much fat under the skin just falls into little tiny pieces, and it's just horrible, really horrible. So after quite a long time, the Oxford Museum decided that this thing just wasn't worth keeping, and they burnt it. But luckily, a curator at the time rescued a few bits from the fire, which included the dried-out head, and you can just still see a few little burnt hairs on the top of the head that used to be feathers, and took out one foot. So this is the only bit of dodo skin left in the whole world. So, of course, I had to go to Oxford Museum to draw this, and luckily they were very accommodating. Now, you might be thinking, well, hang on, Katrina used to work at the Natural History Museum in London. And so I did. I was the curator there, which in America is what they call a collections manager. So my job was to look after the collections and look after the people that use the collections, which was a proper full-time job, and it was kind of expected that I wouldn't do my own work there, and I never did, and I kept my private life private, and so I never ever actually drew any specimens in the Natural History Museum in the 7 years that I worked there, which was fine, and so I kept my two worlds completely separate. So instead I used other museums, and quite a lot of American museums sent me specimens on loan, which was really kind of them. But as I said, there are two different sides to museums. There's the side that you see actually in the public galleries, usually articulated skeletons put together in positions, often behind glass. So it's really difficult sometimes to look round the back of a skeleton. And when you're drawing, you really need to look round all sides to see what's going on. So when they're behind glass, it's actually quite difficult to see. Almost always, they're in very boring positions which don't really reflect on the animal's behaviour. And they might be in... they probably were put together by somebody who didn't really know the animal in life, so maybe completely misleadingly wrong positions. They may have been damaged over time, or worse still, damaged and then put together by somebody else who didn't really know what they were doing, or mounted in inaccurate postures, as I said. Or they might simply be wrong. This albatross, which is in a very strange position and a very boring position, even worse still, he's got his feet on the wrong way round. So, yeah, museums are great, and sometimes it's all that you actually have, but you have to really, really know when something's wrong or not. But the actual real valuable, the real treasure in museums is behind the scenes, is behind those doors that says staff only, no entry. And most museums have got scientific collections for scientists to study. The bad news is that, not for the scientists, but the bad news is for artists, that the skeletons in these collections often look like this, which is great absolutely necessary for scientists using them. Skeletons in museum collections are normally used by archaeologists, and they need to study the tips of the bones, the bits where they join to each other, and all the little nodules and facets of that. So they're not much good if they're actually drilled and with wires shoved in and glued onto the next bone. They're useless for scientists to study. So they're almost always just loose in a box like this, and then the scientists can pick them out bone by bone and look through them and study them close up. But for artists, that's not really very useful. And sometimes it's all we can get. More about that later. So it's clear I'll actually have to prepare my own skeletons or find somebody else to do it for me. I was actually quite busy drawing all the pictures and writing all the text. So I managed to find... I had to track down a man who could prepare skeletons. I found one finally in the Netherlands and married him. He's quite nice looking too. So first of all, before I go into the actual examples, no bird was harmed during the making of the unfeathered bird. Where did I get all these specimens from, you might ask? Well, lots of animal hospitals and vets gave them to me. Conservation charities, the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, gave me their whole freezer full and said, there you go, take them away. Zoos, aviculturists, bird parks, they were fantastic. They would pass on a lot of specimens to us, of exotic things, hornbills and toucans and so on. Taxidermists are fantastic because taxidermists work so slowly that even though they've got lots of things to prepare for clients, by the time they get round to doing them, the client's usually died. I'm serious too. Roadkills, beachcombings. I had a lovely, lovely boyfriend up in Scotland who spent years just picking up every single dead bird in the whole of the Highlands. And we lived with his mother, she was okay, and his stepfather. And his stepfather didn't really like dead birds in the freezer. So he would disguise them all as pies. And you might think, what if the stepfather fancied a pie? But he was ever so clever, and he disguised them as pies and said they belonged to next door because next door didn't have a freezer. And corpses to prepare for other institutions. So when certain places wanted a dead bird prepared for their educational display, for example, they'd say, there you go, you put it together, you draw it, and I'll have it back when it's done. I know it's very different here in America for owning and picking up dead birds. The laws are very different. In the UK, you're allowed to pick up dead birds. You're meant to keep documentation as to where they came from and how they died. And the only restriction really is that you mustn't sell them. So, from feathered bird to the unfeathered bird, this is our Van Gogh preparation process. I'm going to take you through a certain example. This is a great bustard. This is one that we did prepare for another institution. The Great Bustard Group busily work in England trying to reintroduce bustards back onto this beautiful area, big flat area called Salisbury Plain in Wiltshire, which was the last stronghold of bustards when they lived in Britain. And they've been bringing in young birds from Russia and now from Spain and releasing them onto Salisbury Plain. It's absolutely important, absolutely vital that in order to put together a skeleton and draw it in a lifelike position, you've really, really got to know your birds in life. You've got to know how they behave, what they do. So we went to Salisbury Plain to have a look for ourselves. And we wanted to do a displaying bustard, because when bustards display, they turn into this. It's sort of a chaotic ball of feathers, and it's really difficult to work out what on earth is going on. In fact, the actual truth is disappointingly simple. It's all in the feathers. It's all the way the feathers twist round. But we thought it would be a jolly good idea to actually show anatomically what's happening when these bustards display. Now, this particular bird, this is Purple Five. He lives out on Salisbury Plain still. We went there to watch Purple Five and also to collect Purple Six. Poor Purple Six. Purple Six was in liquid form when we collected him. And he was scraped up from a field and put into a plastic bag, which was then stuck into a freezer and then given to us. It was pretty disgusting. Even Hein thought so. But the pets liked it. There we are. Now, the first job was to actually find the bones, which took some time and a lot of very close work to look through all that gunk. It was really quite foul. Now, museums have got domestic beetle colonies. They get a nice fresh bird and they take off all the big lumps of muscle and they just pop the bird into a box with all these beetles to take all the rest of the meat off. And then a few days later, they just take out the skeleton and say, thank you very much, and take it away and do what they want with it. We didn't have one of those. We had to do it the manual way. The chicken's still hanging around there, which meant sifting through all the gunk in the kitchen sink, boiling it up on the stove in the kitchen, cleaning it all, gradually, boil it up, and then soak it in some very dilute hydrogen peroxide for a couple of days, and then dry it all on the draining board. And it kind of took over the house, really. But then at the end, hey presto, you get this beautiful specimen, all put together with wires and super glue, and there's Hein looking very pleased with himself. About 10 minutes earlier, he was swearing at that bird and really losing his temper. And there he is, the finished bustard. And say, in a very, very boring position, really, considering what they look like with the feathers on. But at least it shows what they do. And there's my drawing of him. I've got this really stupid habit of always working life-size, which is completely impractical and causes lots of problems, and I just can't seem to get out of the habit. And in fact, now I've gone on to working on cows and horses, which is going to cause a few more problems. That particular picture, which was immortalised, I found this online. It was in Discover magazine's Best Science Art Books of the Year, and it reached number 4, and I was very pleased to see it, but look what they've done to my nose. Oof. Now, the difference is between that picture you saw just now and this one is that this one's a lovely sepia colour. Now, I didn't want my I was working pencil, and for you artists amongst us, I just work in a 2B or a B pencil, nothing else. I don't work in different grades. But I do all the drawing in lead pencil, but it looks a bit black and white. It looks grey, which I felt was a bit too academic looking and a little bit too suggestive of those textbooks. So I wanted to change all that. I wanted to suggest something a bit more historic, something a bit more, just give it a bit of warmth. So digitally I changed the images into this nice warm sepia colour. And lots of people might think, well, I'm interested in the outside of birds. I mean, why do I want to know about anatomy? Anatomy is for scientists. I'm just a birder. All I care about is the outside of birds. But in fact, birds, form and function are inseparable. You can't have one without the other. And understanding a bit about anatomy is just so, so important to understanding the behaviour of birds. And understanding behaviour is just so closely, inextricably linked with anatomy. It just enriches your knowledge and understanding of live birds. And underneath all the fluffy, pretty feathers, birds are intricate, complicated, perfectly engineered machines, all absolutely different. Even though all birds evolved from a single flying ancestor, they've all evolved in completely different ways, and the engineering behind a woodpecker is different from a hummingbird, is different from an ostrich, is different from a bird of paradise. They're all completely different and just fantastic pieces of machinery, perfectly engineered to do just what they do best. So here's the woodpeckers again, one with his skin taken off, apart from the and all the feathers apart from the tail. The other one's a skeleton. Both the same species. They're both great spotted woodpecker. And well, first of all, you can see just how long that tail is under the feathers. That it's a really, really long, stiff tail. And it kind of acts as a third limb. It acts as a brace. And it's really important for bouncing around on the trunks of trees. Now, what woodpeckers do best is they hang onto vertical surfaces, which is actually really difficult, and they belt hell out of tree trunks really, really, really hard. So hard that if you were to do it with your head, beak, base, you would probably kill yourself straight away. But woodpeckers don't. Woodpeckers do this for a living. And every single thing about woodpeckers is just so perfect for bashing hell out of tree trunks really hard. They've got a non-flip-up beak. They've got a special bit of overhanging bone just there to stop their beak from going boing. They've got a thickened skull. You can see those little dots on the skull. That's where the bones sort of thickened, and so they don't sort of, you know, break their skull as soon as they hit the wood. But they've got really, really enlarged vertebrae because of all those muscles and ligaments that have to support the hammering motion. Even their ribs, look at that, even their ribs are enlarged and thickened. Everything about a woodpecker channels the force down right the way through the whole skeleton, all through the muscles, back into the tree trunk. They're just perfect bashing machines. And here's another sort of woodpecker. This is a green woodpecker. Not quite so much of a bashing machine. This is one more of a ground feeder. But they've got quite a long tongue. And you can see it's got little hairy bits on the end. Also, a very big gland just here. That's the saliva that makes the hairy bits sort of stick to the ants. But what's really exciting about these is their tongue, the back end of their tongue, called the hyoid horns, goes right the way around the back of the skull. It's so long, it actually comes down over the top of the skull in special little grooves there. Look at that. It's even little channels made for it, like a drain pipe. And down into the right nostril. Pretty cool, huh? But lots of people know about green woodpeckers, but they don't actually know that hummingbirds, many species of hummingbirds have got the same thing. These little channels here. And it goes right the way down into the right nostril again. This is a sword-billed hummingbird. Turcos, violet turco, beautiful things. Toco toucan. These are both birds that bounce. These bounce from one branch to another. They're not brilliant flyers. In fact, toucans even get tired and worn out flying over wide rivers. But these are great birds for forests. They don't need to go very far. They don't migrate. But what they do is they bounce from one branch to another, from one branch to another, all the way up the tree, and then they glide down a little bit of flapping to the next tree and then start bouncing again. And you see this toucan's looking a little bit worried about being in the air there. Why are they not great flyers? Well, here's the answer. You know, when you put a wishbone, you know, when you have your chicken dinner, you pull the wishbone and it's impossible to break right down the middle, isn't it? Really, the two halves of the wishbone are so firmly stuck together that you either get good luck or you get bad luck because it's impossible to break them down the middle. They're absolutely firmly fused together. But on toucans and tuecos, they're actually separate. The two halves don't meet. And when we first took this toucan out of the pan and looked at the skeleton, well, that's strange, the two halves of the wishbone don't meet. And we did wonder if it correlated with the flying ability. And lo and behold, when we looked at the different tuaco species that live in the desert, and of course in the desert trees are a little bit further apart, so they have to do a bit more flapping. And lo and behold, the tuacos that live in the desert do have wishbones that are fused. Pretty neat. This, believe it or not, this is a bird of paradise. And you'd think that for a bird, you know, in the bird of paradise family, that these are kind of drawn the short straw, wouldn't you? I mean, they're about as unspectacular. You can imagine them sitting in a tree opposite one of those big blue things that hang upside down and go, woo, woo, woo. Oh, that's not fair. Why haven't I got one of those? But this is a trumpet manicode, and when you're a trumpet manicode, you don't need to hang upside down with those silly blue feathers. No, you don't need that because you've got a windpipe like this. Now, they're not called trumpet manicodes for nothing because they really, really are loud. They've got a long windpipe that gives them all that extra noise. And they fit this lovely long windpipe into their body by spiralling it around just underneath the skin, which is really quite remarkable. Now, quite a lot of birds that have got loud voices, usually forest birds, so as they can communicate with other forest birds without needing to be seen. Actually, they're migrating birds as well, cranes and swans, they've also got long windpipes for communicating on migration. The manicodes are the only songbirds that have got this, and they're quite unique in having it just under the skin. The swans and the cranes have actually got their windpipes embedded into the bone. In cranes, it's embedded right the way into the breastbone, which is amazing. And finally, this is an ostrich foot. Ostriches are the only birds that have only got two toes. Now, all birds started out with four toes. They've got one behind and three in front. Some birds have got different variations. They've got two in front, two behind, or all sorts of other things. But in fact, again, for the artists amongst you, lots of people complain that feet are really difficult to draw. Here's a really useful tip. Now, in a normal bird's foot, the bone that's behind is actually just on the inside edge. It just sort of sticks out here. And that's digit number one. So, three in front, from inside out to outside, digit number two, digit number three, digit number four. This is a really good way for artists and other people studying these things to remember how many bones are in each toe. Digit one, one bone. Digit two, two bones. Digit three, three bones. Digit four, four bones. It's really good when it's easy to remember, isn't it? Well, ostriches have only got two toes, and you can tell that they've lost their inner toe because this outside toe here has got four bones in it. So they've lost the one that's only got two. They've lost it so as they can run fast. But if you actually look at the back of an ostrich's foot, this is just so nice. Look at that. It's almost as though somebody's taken a knife and just gone just up the bone. Like a little sliver of bone sticking out, and that is all that's left of the inner toe. There. So, just talk a little while about the day-to-day at home with Katrina Van Grauw, sort of drawing practicalities and problems and decisions and things. This is a penguin porpoising out of the water, you know, like the way they do. When I was choosing which position to draw this penguin in, I thought, fantastic, two for the price of one. You don't I only had 304 pages in the book, so I wanted to show the underneath of the penguin as well as the top part of the penguin, so the penguin from the side. What better way than to show a reflection? And to do this, you take your penguin, skin it, get somebody to hold it over a mirror for a very long time. And exactly the same idea, of course, you all know that that's the... But you had a bit of a hint beforehand with the Monty Python budgie thing, but to show the front of a budgie skull, which is really quite an interesting shape, as well as the back, and also, of course, to show, everybody knows, to show that it's a budgie. You give it a mirror and there's nothing else it could be. And, okay, this is the picture of the rook, one of the first pictures I did for the book. You'd think it was three rooks all rushing towards this little worm down here. There he is, just poking out the hole. I don't think the rook's going to get him somehow. But this is actually one bird. You can just see him up there on the plate. We took the feathers off and drew the bird with to show the feather tracks where the feathers grow from. Because feathers on birds grow from certain areas with spaces in between, rather than all over the bird. And they're all, a lot of different groups are subtly different. So, yep. Wanted to show the feather tracks. Then we took the skin off. You can see him up there with the skin taken off and did this one. And then I gave the rook to my husband. He took it away to the kitchen. And a few weeks later, I get a nice rook in the front to finish the picture with. Birds, people often ask me, which is more difficult? Is it more difficult to draw the whole skeleton, or is it more difficult to draw the birds with the muscles? And everybody would think that skeletons being really intricate and three-dimensional would be much more difficult. Wrong. Dead birds are floppy. They just want to hang like that. And it's really, really, really difficult to get them to actually sort of kind of pose in the right position. Audubon would have really understood this and really sympathised with this because he propped his dead birds up, his freshly shot birds with feathers on. He used to prop them up with all sorts of wires and things, and I think in his diary he said the first one was a tolerable-looking dodo. It was a kingfisher. It was a tolerable-looking dodo, and he smashed it into pieces and started again. And So he would certainly have sympathised with this problem. We used cotton, we used wires, we used matchsticks, we used everything possible, all sorts of things, anything that came to hand to try and prop these floppy dead birds up into a position where I could draw them. And, of course, you spend hours doing that and really, really get cross with it. And finally, by the time you get in the right position, it's the end of the day and you just want to go and open a bottle of wine and say to hell with it. So the bird ends up going back in the fridge until the next day. Now, another way of doing it is to just start with an outline of a bird doing something, the outline of perhaps a living bird, and then just refer to the floppy dead one as you go along, which is what I did with this cormorant. Excuse the little mouse there. He's kind of a pet mascot, you know. But this meant having a bloody dead cormorant draped over my lap because there was nowhere else on the surface to put it while I was drawing all the details, which... It's a bit messy and very impractical. But kind of worth it in the end. This is one of my favourite pictures from the book. And the major, major problem with drawing that I encountered was when I couldn't actually get a specimen for myself. And nowhere was this more awkward than the picture of the frigate bird chasing the tropic bird. Now, frigate birds, my husband told me not to even put the picture in, but I insisted because frigate birds are my favourite birds and tropic birds are my second favourite birds. Frigate birds are the most exciting birds in the world. If you've never seen one, go somewhere exotic and see them because they're wonderful. And tropic birds are beautiful. They shine. They're just gorgeous. Now, frigate birds are what they call kleptoparasites. They chase other birds and make them vomit whatever they've eaten or drop whatever they're carrying. So they've got wonderful, manoeuvrable flight and very unstable in the air. They look like pterodactyls. They're incredible things. So I insisted on having this picture in. The only problem was we couldn't get a dead frigate bird. This one was loaned to us by Chicago Museum. It's a box of bones, and I had the problem of drawing that in a lifelike position. But what I did manage to get was the tropic bird. A friend of mine carried it back in their dirty laundry, smuggled it through customs from some far-flung Indian Ocean island. So we put the tropic bird together, and I'm going to let you into a secret now how I did this, and I'm afraid that I'll have to kill you afterwards or something. But I chose the same position for the tropic bird, the same position, just seen from a different angle to draw my frigate bird. And I drew it onto tracing paper, flipped over, and then one by one I rubbed out every single bone, every bone on the tropic bird, and redrew it as a frigate bird's bone. So the drawing started this big, ended up this big, and really worked rather well, actually. So I've completely transformed a tropic bird skeleton into a frigate bird. There's not a single tropic bird bone on this drawing. It's 100% frigate bird, but I just used this as a sort of model. And it was a really clever thing to do, actually. I was really rather proud of myself. And using the same technique, I changed a nightjar into a swift and changed a pigeon into a sandgrouse. It does work very well. Right, fact. It's a fact universally acknowledged, doesn't the quote go? All the best things happen in pubs. And over 2 decades after I took Amy to pieces and had the first idea for the book, I met Robert Kirk of Princeton University Press in a pub in England at the British Birdwatching Fair, and I've never looked back since. Princeton took me up and accepted the book, and it allowed me to make all my own decisions about it. They were absolutely fantastic, really, really wonderful. They allowed me to design the cover, every page, do all the layout. They even put up with my very sort of stubborn insistence that everything had to be on cream-coloured paper, and they couldn't afford to buy cream-coloured paper, so they printed every single page of white paper cream first before they even printed the pictures over the top. How good is that? They were just wonderful. And that was when the real work actually started. So publisher, I've got my book idea, I've got some of the pictures done, and right, ready to go. This is when the work really started to take off. So, the final countdown. Transformed the house. The house was absolutely taken over. So here's a few little snapshots, a few little postcards from the house. The kitchen, the draining board, skeletons drying, penguin feet in pans on the stove, peacock bodies hanging up in the windows. That's somebody's windpipe there on top of the toaster. A vase of peacock by the sink. And isn't it normal to have toucans in the sink? The china cabinet, my precious china cabinet where I keep my Audubon plates, was taken over by bones, bodies drying, toucans, thing. And the Audubon plates are up the top shelf. There they are. But just everything just taken over by more and more and more bones. Every shelf, every surface, taken over by skeletons, the cupboards populated by featherless birds. Just the population growing and growing and growing. And when I got down to the last year, my husband and I sat down, how many birds left to draw? So I had 107 left on my list, and I made a greatly long list of them, and my husband laid down the law, and he said, right, nothing shall be added, only substituted. You're not allowed to add a single other bird. This is, just this. Otherwise, you carry on forever, another 25 years. I mean, yes, dear, of course, dear. And of course, I did add things. The more I read, the more I thought, oh, I've simply got to have a tuaco's foot, or I've simply got to have a so-and-so. And so I'd sort of sneak a few extra pictures in whenever I could get a chance. But there was my list, and there was the countdown list on the wall. And gradually, it was all crossed off, and numbers went down. The final picture I did was a picture of a cormorant. It was a very, very hot week, and I was sweating, and I had to wash my hands every few minutes and I had blisters and... Oh. And then as soon as it was finished, oh, I don't like this. What do I do now? I felt utterly bereft when the book was finished. A normal, everyday sort of scene from the house, but I kind of like this one. Pets at home. It was, yeah, a bit of a sad fact that even though everything else was so positive at the time, unfortunately, my employers don't allow curators to write books in their spare time. Not in the work time, but in their spare time. So it was a heartbreaking thing that I actually had to leave my job at the museum, even more so because I'd never actually done any drawing there. I'd always been, you know, just any other curator doing my job. So a very, very sad kind of side thing to getting a publisher and a bit of a dark patch on the very exciting horizon of what was going on at the time. So back to Audubon again, back to our friend. And here he is looking rather old and haggard. This was at the end of his life when he'd already finished Birds of America. This is kind of how I felt when I finished The Unfeathered Bird. Now, in the beginning, Audubon had inspired my pictures of living birds. Big dramatic things, you know, birds chasing each other, you know, doing exciting things in the air. But he became so much more of a poignant, important influence for so many other reasons. And I could see sort of similarities between his project, his Birds of America, what he called his great idea. I could see similarities between that and The Unfeathered Bird. Now, I wouldn't for a moment compare myself with Audubon, but when the going got tough, I would think about what Audubon did and I'd carry on. He was just a shining example of just hard work in the face of adversity. Just so much determination, just so much inflexibility, pig-headedness, doing pictures at life-size. He had to go across the Atlantic to find his publisher. I had to go across the Atlantic to find... Well, I didn't have to go across the Atlantic, but I found my publisher in America. Audubon found his publisher in England. He was just such a inspiration through those final years. A book like that kind of takes it out of you. It puts so many strains on everyday life. I've never been so driven, but it does put so many strains on it, everything. And there were times in the last year that I just wanted to give it all up. And I would think about Audubon and just carry on another specimen, another day, another week. So I clung to my own great idea through 25 years until the book that began with a single dead duck, you know what's coming next, grew into a very fine swan indeed. Now, you must be thinking, oh, she's forgotten something. She hasn't mentioned those domesticated birds. So, postscript, domesticated birds. And if you think you're going to be bored, think again. Domesticated animals are really very, very interesting. For example, Polish fowl. You may have seen pictures of these. These are a nice old breed. They've got a little top knot of feathers on their head. They're very decorative, they're very pretty. And they've got a skull like this, which is quite neat. They've got a big lump on the top. And what goes with them, the mutation that causes that, because most different breeds in domesticated animals are caused by mutations, as mutations cause variety in all animal species. And the mutation that usually what happens is a breeder will say, oh, that's interesting, this bird's grown a funny lump on its head, I like that, I'll put that with another one and see if I can breed some more. And whether it's recessive or dominant, you may or may not have any luck, but gradually new breeds emerge, just like new species emerge in the wild. And the mutation that causes this funny little top knot of feathers on the head is caused by a lump of expanded cranial bone. And the mutation goes hand in hand with this. You'd think it was broken, wouldn't you? But it's not. It's actually birds that have got that have also got that. It's kind of a free gift. Buy one, get one free. And you think that Polish fowl would be just the same as these fellows, crested ducks. There we are. Another thing popular in old paintings. Wrong. We have the head of a crested duck boiling away in a pan, and the water was all murky, and then the water cleared. We saw this. a duck with horns. And what actually happens is the bird's got an extra hole in the head, not the one where it joins onto the neck, but an extra hole, which sometimes fills in as the bird gets older. But what's going on is the body is putting out its defences, so it builds up this big fatty layer over the top of this hole, and that's what gives you this nice little curly sort of top knot. It's just a layer of fat on top of the head. But also, though, the bone is going, oh my God, there's a hole where it shouldn't be, the brains are not protected, oh, what do I do? And the skull, the bones, will actually push out these tendrils of extra bone to try and repair the damage. It's like sort of sending in the, you know, emergency services, and they just pile up on all this. But of course, it doesn't actually fill up the hole like it should. It grows out like these crazy horns, and sometimes it even actually goes into the brain cavity, right into the brains. And not surprisingly, these crested ducks aren't really very with it, and they sometimes walk, you know, sort of fall over and not walk into walls. It's really quite sad, but very interesting. Japanese bantam, also very interesting. You might think it looks a bit strange. It looks a bit strange because it's got really short legs. What you might not notice straight away is it's also got really short wings. And this is a type of dwarfism, exactly the same thing that gives us basset hounds and dachshunds. It's a basset hound. So short back legs, short forelimbs, and normal size of everything else. Incidentally, the reason I mentioned this, I was going to put this extra story in, because we had the little sketch at the beginning, the Monty Python sketch about burying a cat. This is a really nice little story that I've got to tell you. We wanted to get hold of a dead munchkin cat. Who knows what a munchkin is? Not somebody, something from The Wizard of Oz. Nobody knows what a munchkin is. That's really good. Munchkin is a short-legged cat. It's the cat equivalent of a dachshund or a basset hound. And they've got tiny little short legs, and it's a brand new breed from America. And we thought that finding a munchkin was going to be almost impossible. But there's Hein saying, finding a munchkin is going to be almost impossible. And I said, you might be surprised, ... And within half an hour, he'd managed to find a munchkin breeder in the Netherlands, where he comes from. And not only did she have about 40 munchkins, but she'd had one made into, well, not, it died naturally, but after it had died, she had it made into a skeleton. How easy was that? And she said, oh, by all means, come over and draw my skeleton. And she sent us a photograph of it, which I thought was not a brilliantly put together skeleton. So we said, if one dies, can we have it? Oh, yes, certainly. Anyway, we went over there to look at her skeleton, and she said, oh, I'm really, really, really sorry. One of my munchkins died, and I buried it. Damn. And then she came out with a spade and said, but you can dig it up if you want to. So we were out in the garden digging up poor Alice, and there's a little gravestone on there. Oh, it's ever so sad, but Alice is going to be a very nice picture in the next book. So, the next book. This is Charles Darwin. This is a photograph of Charles Darwin. It is Pigeon Shed. The next book is going to be called Unnatural Selection, which might ring a bell. And that is not a coincidence, because Charles Darwin was a huge fan of domesticated animals, and he kept pigeons. Now, everybody thinks about Galapagos finches as being the main driving force behind the Origin of Species. Wrong. Actually, it was our humble domesticated pigeons. Not racing pigeons, not feral pigeons, but what we call fancy pigeons. Now, Darwin was a huge... That isn't really Darwin, that's from a film. But Darwin was a huge fan of fancy pigeons, and he did lots of experimental breeding with them to work out his evolutionary theories. So they kind of got a good heritage of science behind domesticated animals. Ordinary people like I used to be, and a lot of bird watchers and so on think, oh yeah, domesticated things, they're just monstrosities, they're just man-made sort of awful things, and they think of them in hand in hand with two-headed calves and things like that. No, this is how species change. I heard a lovely story the other day from a geologist whose father lives out in the sort of far west, and They never ever talked about the E word. They never talked about evolution, because he suspected that his father didn't agree. And one day they actually did broach the subject, and the father said, "Yes, you're right, son. I do see that species can change, because I've seen the changes in my own livestock over the years, and my father was alive. So now I've decided that species can change." I mean, isn't that wonderful? Again, domesticated animals inspired Darwin and gave him a lot of the raw material for his Origin of Species. And then afterwards, he went on to produce another book as a backup, just based on domesticated animals only. So my book is going to be like a continuation of Darwin's variations, updated with a lot of genetic stuff. It's going to include dogs, cats, chickens, ducks, goldfish, rabbits, horses and cattle. There's so much there. There's so much good stuff that it can tell us about all sorts of different fields in science. So back to the pigeons. Sorry, I've droned on about that a bit long. Back to the pigeons. This is a pouter pigeon. This is one of Darwin's favourites. They're wonderful things. All pigeons puff themselves up and coo and strut around. Pouter pigeons do it and then some. And they puff up their crop and they've been selectively bred to be very long and upright and thin, and they've got these lovely feathers that spread out over them. But I wanted to show what they look like under the feathers. How do you think, can anybody guess, and that's a rhetorical question, can anybody guess how you draw an inflated crop on a pigeon? I mean you know what I've said already about the the floppy birds. Good, nobody's put their hand up. Right. If you're in the company of a responsible adult, get rid of them. Tell them to go away. Ensure pigeon is not alive. Insert condom. Any brand, nothing fancy, no particular flavour. Put it down its throat via the beak. Then you've got to blow in the end and try not to laugh, because then all the air comes out again, and then tie a knot in the end and pop it down the throat. There we are, tie a knot in the end, and draw. And yeah, you probably think I'm joking, but just to prove that I'm not joking, there we are. And finally, a picture of a peacock, just like the peacock at the beginning and the front and back cover of the book. This is me studying the back end of a peacock, but this slide's especially chosen to remind us all that it's all about live birds. It's not a textbook, it's all about live birds, the same live birds that inspire and enrich all of our lives. And yeah, it's all about live birds. Thank you. Any questions?
Hi there. Two questions. The first is, and it, maybe that you ended with Darwin is why I'm asking the question. Should we understand that these are all current? Like this is this bird, which of course has evolved over millions of years, but what you did was capture it now. Like, in other words, you're not excavating, as it were. These are the birds. You're showing how they look today.
Yes.
Okay. And then the second question is, you didn't, or I didn't hear it, maybe.
Oh, so do you mean just on the domesticated ones?
Kind of the whole thing. Right.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is, something I didn't get very much of is, could you just give a sense of how your artistry evolved? Like, 25 years is a long time. So you showed us, I think you showed at one point, you said, this is the first, or this is the first one that I did. I didn't necessarily get a sense of sequence, and I guess the book would tell me that, but I'm just curious, as an artist, as your skill evolved, what was that like over 25 years? Like, for example, if I look at the first print and I look at the last, am I going to see you having evolved as an artist, or...?
In the book, all the... there's no chronology. So you won't be able to see more primitive pictures at the beginning and more advanced ones at the end. They're all kind of mixed together. I did find that some of my earlier pictures were more loose and they did tighten up towards the end. But the main thing, I think, was having a more of a sense of the whole bird. With a lot of the earlier pictures, the birds that I hadn't actually joined together, you didn't really get a sense of, for example, the rib cage being a vessel. I would put as much detail on the backside of the ribs and put as much light on there. And towards the end, I was using light more and using shadows more, and so you get more of a sense of space within the skeleton, and I'm using shadows to show the shapes of things. So I think towards the end they're getting more dramatically lit, but also sort of tighter as drawings. Okay. One of the early pictures that I showed about my pictures of living birds, I mean, there are no pictures like that in the book. All the pictures are anatomical. But it was intended to be sort of background studies for my picture of living birds, but that was when I decided that it would be a really, really good thing to do, to do an anatomy book for other artists. Okay.
How did you choose the birds to Sorry? Put it? How did you make your choices?
Oh,
about
good,
which birds
good question.
To include.
I could have gone on forever. I could have just gone on and on, adding more and more species. I really wanted to, too. And the more I read, the more I discovered, and the more I took birds to pieces, the more I, you know, sort of wanted to go from one thing to the next, and then to do something similar to see how it's different. It was an exploration, it really was, and I could have just carried on and on and on. If they gave me 500 pages, if they said one day, oh, you can do another edition, here's a bigger one with 500 pages, I'm hoping they will, then I will fill it straight away. I could just go on and on. Yep.
Did you choose birds from different families?
Yes.
Yes,
I've tried to include most of the non-passerine families, so most of the non-songbirds. I couldn't do everything, there just weren't enough pages in the book to do everything, but I did try to choose most of the things that were anatomically interesting. And as I say, the more I read and the more I found out, the more I sort of thought, oh yeah, I've simply got to include that. There are 385 pictures of 200 species in the book, which is quite a lot. So...
Dare I ask if you have a favourite bird or favourite image of a bird?
Yes,
book?
And the favourite live bird is the same as the favourite bird drawing, skeleton drawing, and that's the frigate bird. I was really, really pleased with that one. My second favourite is the cormorant, the one with the mussels on. Actually, can I go back quickly to, because you're talking about birds that are extant now. I've recently been looking at a lot of bird fossils and getting very, very excited to see how they sort of fit in with current bird families. And, yeah, getting kind of ideas about maybe even in the next one, including some fossil birds, if there is a next one, including some fossil birds and talking about what they're discovering with feathered dinosaurs.
I just wanted to say I've finishing the book for the third time now, and I really
wow.
think it's a wonderful book. Far even better than all the things you've covered. I think there's more in it than that. But I would say even the cream-colored paper you were right about.
Oh,
it works perfectly.
Thank you
but
ever so much.
As an artist, I find myself sort of odd asking this, but I really love the writing. So I'm curious as to how much effort you spent in the writing.
Quite a lot. I really enjoyed writing it, and I'm so pleased that you've enjoyed that, because it's easy for people to look at it as an art book and say, oh, it's just full of nice pictures. But I'm absolutely thrilled that, in fact, so many people have commented on the writing, and that has been just a lovely surprise. I really enjoy writing and want to write a lot more in the future, so I'm delighted that people are enjoying that. Thank you.
Are all the parts of the birds the same, i.e. a city bird and a hawk, when you're talking about, say, the hands and the feet, the ulna, and some of the other things, or are there differences depending on the smaller birds versus the larger ones?
It's not so much smaller versus larger. It's different different behaviour, different modes of living. In terms of sort of wings, there's not that much variation in wing in numbers of bones and so on, but there's a huge variation in length. And some birds, for example, shearwaters and albatrosses, have got projections on which lock the wings in place. Legs, as you've seen, that there's a huge amount of variation in legs. But it's not so much the size, it's the mode of life. It's all in the book.
No, and did you ever work as an ornithologist?
I guess I was technically working as an ornithologist when I was a bird curator at the Natural History Museum. Yep. And also I've been employed as a bird ringer, a bird bander as well.
Hi. Hi. What got you first interested in the, I would call it a surgical approach to birds and interested in actually doing hands-on, you know, anatomical study of birds?
I wanted to understand how birds work so as I would do better pictures of living birds.
But initially, I mean, did you have any training? I mean, initial training in it sounds like you trained as an ornithologist, but then...
Yes, training, well, I no, actually. but I was trained and taught myself to skin birds, and I was trained as a bird bander, and I've got no actual science training, none whatsoever.
Katrina, we can take one more question.
Sure. Oh, there isn't another one. Oh, yes, there is, good.
Are you planning to do a book of the feathered bird, I mean the actual birds, the way they look with the feathers on?
Lots of people are doing that. I'd rather stick to my strengths, and I've got so many more things I want to do. The domesticated animal book is going to take a while. After that, I would absolutely love to do a book about mammals. And then after that, that's going to be many, many years hence. But after that, I'm hoping that maybe Princeton will give me a few more pages to do some more. Then there's some writing books, and there's some landscape books. And so I think I've got my work out for me for the rest of my years. Okay, thank you. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.